2 years ago this month, Hurricane Sandy changed from a tropical storm in the Caribbean to the largest hurricane on record to hit the Atlantic coast.
Our next guest chronicles the 9 days when Sandy ravaged the eastern seaboard in her new book.
Catherine Miles is a journalist and the author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So when Hurricane Sandy began its approach to the U.S. coastline, did scientists know what they were in for, just how devastating the storm would be?
It took a few days, really. About a week before the storm, we had one model that was showing that it would make landfall in the mid-Atlantic. But the National Hurricane Center uses about 40 models for their prediction. And the 39 were really saying that the storm was going to turn out to sea. So it wasn't until about 4 days before the storm made landfall that we really could say with any confidence that the storm was going to hit. And I think a lot of people were really surprised by just how weird and wonky and non-hurricane-like it was when it made landfall.
And when the outlier came up, I think you're right that the people looking at it said, oh yeah, this is the one thing we know won't happen.
Right, right. I asked the meteorologist at the Mount Holly National Weather Service office that in New Jersey, and they said, you know, it just seemed so ludicrous to us at the time. Like, you know, this would be bucking every possible historical trend. But we soon learned very quickly that, you know, hurricanes love to buck trends.
Well, the storm had a bit of a track record already as it came in from the Caribbean. What did we know about what it had done already as far as its potential?
Well, that's part of what was so unusual about this particular storm is that it began as a very sort of typical traditional hurricane down in the southern Caribbean and followed all the rules of a late season hurricane. But there was a series of unusual circumstances happening meteorologically that caused it both to veer straight towards New York and then also to collide with this nor'easter and create this hybrid storm that soon got dubbed Frankenstorm.
Before we pick up the narrative, you talk some about just how difficult it can be to predict what hurricanes are going to do, where they're going to go, and how powerful they're going to be. What is our state of the art in that now?
Well, you know, meteorologists are quick to sort of say that we still have a long way to go in terms of our weather prediction. They're pretty good at tracking where the storm is going to go. There's still a lot of really minute, sophisticated science involved in terms of storm intensity. And I was really amazed at the number of meteorologists who said to me, you know, look, we're just not very good at this. And then further compounding it is the fact that, you know, these meteorologists are really hemmed in terms of resources, training, funds. You know, they're working double time for not much money with, in some cases, really outmoded equipment. So, you know, in some cases, they have the odds stacked against them.
Has a lot changed since Hurricane Sandy when it comes to storm prediction? Maybe have we figured some things out technologically?
One very significant change has happened. When Sandy collided with that nor'easter and became this hybrid storm, the National Hurricane Center was quite literally incapable of issuing advisories, watches, and warnings for the storm. They told me that they really worried that their software might literally break when this happened. And so in the 11th hour, we saw this really sort of messy decision-making process where the National Weather Service ultimately decided that what they would need to do, since the National Hurricane Center could no longer issue these watches and warnings, is hand over responsibility to regional National Weather Service offices. And they did a heroic job in attempting to sort of carry the burden of the National Hurricane Center, but it really wasn't part of their job description to do this, and it created some confusion in terms of communication. Immediately after the storm, I think nationally, we all looked at this and thought, you know, as one hurricane specialist told me, that was maybe the least lousy of four really lousy options. And so meteorologists across the country got together and made a very decisive decision to sort of extend the ability of the National Hurricane Center. So now the next time we confront a hybrid storm, the National Hurricane Center will be able to issue these watches and warnings, and hopefully that's going to save a lot of lives.
You also tell the story of governmental decision-making. Now, this is a huge decision make to, say, evacuate New York or take other drastic measures. If you evacuate a major city and the hurricane doesn't hit, you've created a lot of maybe unnecessary trouble. What What was the story there in New York City deciding as this thing was approaching how to react to it?
This was one of the most chilling moments in the story of Sandy. You know, all around New York, we saw these very rapid, aggressive evacuation warnings. Connecticut, Philadelphia, Delaware, New Jersey, of course, issuing evacuation warnings very early on in the process. Mayor Bloomberg felt like the information he was receiving suggested to him that the storm would be no worse than Irene, which made landfall indirectly a year earlier. And there was this very sort of bizarre moment in the chronology of the storm where he staged a press conference less than 48 hours before the storm made landfall, where he told all New Yorkers that it was fine, it was no big deal, that city employees should report to work on Monday, and residents should just weigh down their trash cans with a brick. And that created this media firestorm where meteorologists on the Weather Channel, people at Weather Underground, meteorologists on local news stations were just sort of pounding their chests and saying, how could he be so wrong?
Is part of this, you know, maybe both on the part of meteorologists, but also on the part of governments, mayors, sort of magical thinking that they don't want to believe it could be this bad. It's never been this bad before. Why should it be this bad now?
And this is a problem I think that we as a country really face. And this was something I really wanted to unpack in the book. In a lot of ways, the book is a narrative of the specific events surrounding Sandy. But in some other ways, it's really an examination of how, as a country, we deal with risk and also how we deal with an infrastructure crisis. And when I pose this question to social scientists who specialize in risk management and assessment, what they told me is that as a culture, universally, we devalue the risk that natural disaster poses. We think we're much more likely to be involved in a terrorist attack or a nuclear disaster than we do in a really threatening weather situation. And I think time and time again, we've been shown that that actually is not true.
We're talking with Catherine Miles. She's the author of the new book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy.
We're reflecting now on Hurricane Sandy, which ravaged the eastern seaboard 2 years ago this month, and we invite you to join the conversation. Our guest is Catherine Miles. She's the author of Superstorm.
What do you think can or should be done to improve the nation's weather forecasting and emergency response system? Were you there on the eastern seaboard when Sandy was approaching? Do you remember what you thought? Do you think we're too slow to evacuate in the face of hurricanes and other natural disasters in this country? Do we take them seriously enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Catherine, a lot of your book is personal stories of people whose lives were impacted. And one is the captain of a ship from Booth Bay, Maine, who had to make a decision on this clear morning at the beginning of all of this. Skies are clear. The sea is calm. This captain had to make a decision about whether or not to set out to the Atlantic. What happened?
This is the Bounty. It's the recreation of the HMS Bounty, the very famous story of the mutiny, and it was made for the 1960s movie starring Marlon Brando. And the captain considered himself a very traditional seafaring captain. He loved to turn off all the technology on the boat so his crew could learn to navigate by the stars. And, you know, he looked at the weather. The boat had been through several hurricanes before. And he made the decision that he could get out and either get around the storm or make it through the storm. The ship sank very tragically off the coast of North Carolina. Two individuals, including the captain, died. And in a lot of ways, for me, the story of the Bounty became emblematic of the story of so many of us when we're faced with a threat or a risk or disaster and the decision-making that we go through, really, that we just sort of assume we're going to be fine. And I think it's echoed in a lot of the people who chose not to evacuate, in the decisions of people like Mayor Bloomberg. And I really hope it asks all of us to consider how we confront risk.
And you also tell the stories of what happened in hospitals affected by flooding in particular related to the storm. What was happening there?
When Mayor Bloomberg and the city of New York finally did issue the call for evacuation on Sunday, October 28th, so about you know, 24 to 36 hours before the storm was going to make landfall, the city made the decision not to evacuate its most vulnerable citizens, the people who were in nursing homes, residential care facilities, and hospitals. They had done that during Hurricane Irene. They felt like they had put these patients at an undue risk because of that, and so they decided to have people shelter in place. No one imagined that we would have the swath of disaster that ultimately affected New York. And for these enormous hospitals, including Bellevue, they were soon without power. Tragic stories of patients who were on life-saving devices that suddenly went dead. Heroic stories of nurses and maintenance workers working together to evacuate patients. Everyone from premature infants to 300-pound people with heart failure down, you know, 18, 20 flights of stairs. In some cases, the patients remained for days and days and days in a situation not unlike what we saw in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. And there are multiple lawsuits currently underway in New York City because people feel they were mistreated during the storm.
We go to a caller now. Bill is joining us from Tomahawk. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My comment is that during both the New Orleans and the New York disaster, I never heard anybody ask for help and give specific details on where you could go to sign up or to be considered a helpful person. I'm an RN. My license was current. I would have been willing to help in either instance probably, but there was no way that I know about, and I don't know anything on public radio where they ever ask for volunteers.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Bill. Appreciate your comments. He's getting at that he feels that it was hard for people to assist, that there might have been large groups of people who flocked to the cause of aiding either of these situations, but it was hard to figure out what to do.
As citizens and as the public, we tend to really undervalue risk. And in a lot of times, I think we really just sort of tend to ignore what forecasters and scientists are telling us. In that same press conference that Mayor Bloomberg had, he told the citizens of New York that President Obama had offered the assistance of FEMA, and he told the president that that assistance wasn't needed. There's a kind of hubris that we seem to suffer from that seems to suggest we don't need help, this isn't going to happen to us. And we also, I think, tend to be a lot more responsive than we are preventative as a country. We tend to be more likely to bring in FEMA or the Red Cross after a disaster rather than really invest in the infrastructure that will prevent that disaster from happening.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Our producer, Galen, was in Lower Manhattan during the storm and for the following week. He says it was an unreal experience, no heat or hot water, no grocery stores, no power for over a week. And he says it seemed ridiculous that people only started preparing really the night before and they had to close grocery stores to prevent stampedes. Does that fit into the story you were just telling, Catherine, of we don't want to think about it until it's already on top of us?
That's right. And in the case of New York, by the time evacuation orders were issued, residents of New York were given fewer than 8 hours before mass transit were closed. They were given fewer than 6 hours before transportation for people with functional needs and disabilities was closed. And in fact, a major, very, you know, sort of foundational class action lawsuit was just settled against New York City, saying that people with functional needs were disproportionately disaffected by the storm and not able to get out. So I think what this is going to do is really cause a lot of communities to rethink their emergency management plans and their willingness to act in advance of the storm.
Catherine, is part of this also that, you know, as a country and maybe as a world, we're not always prepared for superstorms, super tornadoes, hurricanes of this size, and that it's something we're all catching up to as the climate changes?
We are, and this goes back a long time. One of the issues that I explore in the book is the fact that we have consistently underfunded the meteorologists who are doing the heavy lifting for our nation. When you look at the history of the National Weather Service and the history of NOAA, you see a history of a lot of politics involved that have nothing to do with weather and nothing to do with meteorologists. So while we have these very talented and hardworking forecasters and meteorologists, they don't always have the funds and the tools that they need. We've chosen as a country to allocate our resources elsewhere, and we're ultimately in what is really an infrastructure crisis right now. And my view is that if we don't really start making some really aggressive injections of funding into these weather programs, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Have you seen any kind of change like that since Katrina, since Sandy, or are we going to have this conversation again after the next big storm?
I worry that we're going to have this conversation again. I think really as taxpayers and voters, we have a real responsibility to sort of shake our elected officials and say, look, you know, we invest in all sorts of things, you know, as a country, but we're not investing in one thing that is immediately tied to both our personal safety and our national security, and that's our weather system.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Catherine Miles, a journalist and the author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy.